All the news, all in one day. This is CNS Action News.
Surgeon hotbed along the main route to Baghdad. It's called the largest air assault since the 2003 invasion.
Good afternoon and welcome to CNS. Today we bring you the latest stories from across campus and around the bay. This year, Oakland has seen nearly twice the number of homicides compared to the same time last year. Yesterday, Oakland police and city officials rolled out their plan to fight the deadly trend. Catriona Stewart reports.
Oakland's police union announced yesterday that its contentious battle with the city over police staffing numbers had finally come to an end.
Without question, the changes that we've made in the last 72 hours will assist in bringing crime down in Oakland.
During peak crime times like Friday and Saturday nights, almost twice as many officers will now patrol Oakland streets. Top police brass have been working on the plan for over a month, but their efforts to increase the number of cops on the street have been hindered by union regulations, and crime has continued to rise.
We had a 300% increase in homicides. We had a 156% increase in strong-armed robberies, 56% increase in rapes. Would you feel safe in your neighborhood?
Last Tuesday, Brooks led a city council measure to declare a state of emergency. If it had passed, the police chief would have had the authority to bypass the union and put cops on the street at his discretion.
If crime is at a crisis, and that's what I think I hear and see by watching the news every day, then we don't have months and weeks to just simply wait until we can reach agreement.
Oakland residents are concerned about their safety. On Wednesday, the city's 27th murder of the year occurred here on 38th Avenue in Fruitvale. Police responded to what they thought was an auto accident and a possible shooting, only to find a woman in a car who had been stabbed multiple times.
Many residents say that police have been too slow in responding to 911 calls.
When somebody calls, we call, and the police come too late, our way.
In this neighborhood, it seems like you have to have a really, really, blood and guts type of reason and in order for them to, get a move on.
Getting more cops on the street on a permanent basis will require tough negotiations between city leaders and the police union. In Oakland, this is Catriona Stewart for CNS News.
The current agreement will likely be renegotiated when the police contract expires July 1st. In San Francisco, unlicensed Dr. Stephen Turner allegedly performed at least 1,400 fake medical exams on unwitting immigrants. Yesterday, he faced a judge in Superior Court. Tony D'Aslan was there.
He is very healthy.
In order to become legal citizens, Vivian Goldschweig and her son had to get a medical checkup.
And so he gives us injections and the vaccines that we need to take.
But one thing she didn't expect was that her doctor might be a fake.
It was a shock to hear that.
Case of Stephen Turner.
Today, her doctor, Stephen Turner, was in court facing charges that he drew blood, pretended to give tests like for HIV, and injected 1,400 patients with saline solution, all without a license.
I have confirmed with the DA nobody, to their knowledge, has a physical harm.
Nevertheless, Turner was expected to agree to a plea bargain offered by the district attorney.
Apparently, the plea bargain Turner was offered was harsher than he and his lawyer expected, and he wants time to think about it. But last week, in an interview with CNS News, he admitted to some of the charges.
And I'm very, very troubled by what I did. I did it for the money.
He was really betraying too many people. He made too many victims. He was really abusing.
He really does see that he did something very wrong. He wants to plead and do what the DA needs him to do. We were just hoping it wouldn't be quite so stiff. So.
Frank hopes to get Turner put into a medical facility where he can receive treatment for what he says are psychological problems. And it brings, but for his former patients like Vivian, that would not be enough.
I think he should be in jail for a long time. I really do.
For CNS, this is Tony D'Aslan.
Turner will appear in court again on Thursday to consider the DA's offer. Last night in Oakland, members of the California Nurses Association continued their push for statewide universal health care. The nurses came out to support a bill introduced by State Senator Sheila Kuehl to provide coverage for all Californians. The bill would create a single-payer health care system in California.
Yes, government, oh my goodness, it sometimes is inefficient. But you know what? It's a heck of a lot more efficient than the thousands of insurance companies that are wasting 30% of every health care dollar right now.
A vote on the bill is expected this summer. In San Francisco's Bayview Hunters Point, a major source of air pollution may finally shut down. Nick Goroff was there.
PG&E announced this week that the 78-year-old Hunters Point power plant will close its doors for good this spring. PG&E's announcement comes 8 years after it first promised to close the plant.
I mean, we've heard this before, you know, so it's like the people are like, are they really going to close it?
Pearson is the youth coordinator for Literacy for Environmental Justice, one of the many citizen groups that have worked to shut down the natural gas burning plant.
On the hills, a lot of asthma, birth defects, a lot of problems going on.
Pearson and others in the community attribute high rates of illness to the plant and to dozens of toxic waste sites across Bayview Hunters Point. PG&E says the plant couldn't close until another source of power was guaranteed for San Francisco.
It's going to happen for sure.
And while many like Sudeep Rao are optimistic, residents plan to gather at the plant again this April to make sure that it does, in fact, fire down. This is Nick Goroff for CNS.
What happens on the site next is still up in the air, but PG&E says an agreement with the city guarantees no new power plants will ever be built there. After months of uncertainty, Sacramento's well-regarded McClatchy newspaper chain agreed to buy the much larger Knight Ridder Corporation. Charlotte Buchan has more on the story.
Inside the San Jose Mercury News, it was good news at first. The paper's new owner, the McClatchy Company, has a reputation for quality journalism.
For everyone, it was just kind of like, you know, this everybody's leaping for joy, and in mid-leap, all of a sudden, you know, you get the rest of the news, and it's like, oh.
The rest of the news was McClatchy's announcement that it would sell 12 of the 32 Knight Ridder papers it had just acquired, including two of the Bay Area's top papers, the Mercury News and the Contra Costa Times. Jerry Sepos is a former executive editor of the Mercury News.
Contra Costa is known for its remarkable coverage of just about every community in its region. San Jose is known, of course, for its coverage of both the mechanics of high tech, but also the culture of high tech. Both in recent years have been named the best papers in their category in the state.
So why sell two award-winning newspapers? It's the economy, stupid.
McClatchy's sort of model is to go and try to get papers that are in very high growth markets, like on about an average of an 11% growth in the households in the markets of the papers they're keeping, and I think it's under 4 in the ones that they're deciding to sell.
Some fear that whoever buys the paper from McClatchy will be more concerned with the bottom line. But journalism professor Paul Grabowitz says the sale is emblematic of a changing newspaper industry.
That's what sort of bothered me about this, is this, you know, McClatchy, you know, good guys, well, yeah, but only with a select number of papers, and then the others that try to make a go of it are viewed as sort of villains in all of this. They're taking on papers that are not in a good market, and where there's a trend going on that's much broader than this about the decline of the newspaper industry.
Nationwide, newspaper circulation has dropped about 1% every year since 1990. But the sale of the Mercury News and the Contra Costa Times may lead them in a new and more profitable direction, the web.
Where the web is what's going to be dominant in all of this, rather than just sort of clunking along with the same old business models that just aren't working anymore.
I wonder what would happen, and I'm just making this up, if you took 50 or 100 people from your news staff and diverted them from print to the internet and gave them a mission of developing the very best newspaper website that exists.
Even though the sale has the industry rattled, not everyone is spelling doom and gloom.
I'll tell you something. If I had the money sitting in my bank account, I'd be in there trying to bid for those two papers.
For CNS, this is Charlotte Buchan in San Jose.
The staff at the Mercury News and the Contra Costa Times won't know until July who their new bosses will be. In Cal Campus News, student fees at UC have more than doubled in the past 5 years. Now some students are fighting back. Sasha Woodruff reports.
Student fees pay for everything from teacher salaries to the gym to the Berkeley Art Museum.
I think a lot of the battle has to do with the fact that the registration fee is the same, which means that student services aren't really getting increased, even though students are paying more.
But students say the pinch on the pocketbook is making it hard to hit their school books.
It hits me really personally because I pay out-of-state tuition, and that's why I'm graduating a year early, because I pay like $30,000 to go. Every little fee makes a difference.
Cal graduate Michael Noonan is still paying off his loans and is frustrated by reports on how the regents are budgeting their bucks.
I am very angry about the fact that these guys are installing kitchenettes in their homes while I'm going to be paying interest on my loans.
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger put a moratorium on fee hikes as part of his budget proposal. Yesterday, a group of 200 Cal students returned from a trip to the state capitol, where they appealed to lawmakers to uphold that freeze. Political science major Jeff Marnicero was one of them.
My team of about five students got to meet with two different legislators and talk about a lot of education issues within the UC system and about fees and sort of the trend that's going on right now.
But some suspect an election in fall could be motivating the move.
We want to say that this could be something that could happen every year, but we also recognize that this is a one-time allocation that has a lot of politics behind it.
That's only if the legislature approves the budget in May. Either way, students could be still fighting the same battle next year. For CNS, this is Sasha Woodruff reporting from Berkeley.
Across the bay, Stanford University announced this week it will no longer charge tuition to students whose families earn $45,000 or less. The school says it wants to promote economic diversity. Next, who's in and who's out at UC Berkeley? With admissions decisions looming, Samantha Grant reports that today's students fear fewer African Americans could enroll in September.
In 1996, Prop 209 repealed affirmative action in California. Since then, the number of African-American students on UC campuses has plummeted. Currently, African-Americans make up less than 3% of the undergraduate student body.
Franklin says it wants to reflect California's actual population, so we should probably be closer to 6 or 7%.
Jacqueline Thomas is the co-chair of the Black Recruitment and Retention Center. The organization works to increase the number of African-Americans on campus.
We're about to have like a really big day with my center, BRC Day, where we bring in like 300 middle school kids to like tell them about college.
However, some students feel the university should be doing more.
The university needs to increase faculty and students that are African-American on campus by doing more outreach within the communities that have African-American students and making an effort not to just get them to apply, but also to accept them too.
We came to Sproul Hall to hear from university admissions officials about the low number of African Americans on campus. They were unavailable for an on-camera interview. They did tell us, however, that they're unable to consider race and ethnicity as a factor in the admissions process.
For prospective students like Kama'u Butcher, the number of African Americans on campus could be a deciding factor.
That's definitely a very important factor. Wherever I go, I want to make sure there's a lot of diversity, not just African American, but just a really diverse campus.
Admissions decisions for fall 2006 will be sent within a couple of weeks. That's when we'll know whether efforts to increase minority students on campus have been effective. In Berkeley, this is Samantha Grant for CNS.
Earlier today, I sat down with Robert Boone, the newest editor of the California Law Review at Berkeley's Bolt Hall. The prestigious journal is one of only six law reviews subscribed to by the U.S. Supreme Court. I asked him how he felt about being the Law Review's first African-American editor.
Every time a minority student makes an accomplishment in the field of academia, you know, I think it is a large step, mainly because those individuals have generally not been able to participate in those fields. So I think, on one hand, it's sad that, you know, we're still having to have first in a lot of these areas, but at the same time, that is the situation.
Personally, what did it take you to get here?
When I was a first-year student and was preparing for the write-on competition, there are other minority students who were on the Law Review that really helped me out in terms of preparing me for that process and in terms of, number one, letting me know what the process entails and why it's important that I even attempt to write on to the law review.
Do you see yourself carrying on that role of mentorship?
Definitely. Whenever chance I get, I would like to, take someone to the side and try to explain to them the process and try to help them in any way I can in terms of making them feel comfortable. I'd really like to see the law school give off the image and be more inclusive to the greater Boak community, and particularly those from underrepresented communities, because law reviews generally, not just the California law review, but law reviews generally tend to be homogeneous in terms of the people that make up the law review. When people don't see individuals that look like themselves, and they start to feel that maybe that organization isn't for them. Another goal of mine is to try to eliminate that as much as possible by talking to people and by reaching out to those communities and reaching out to those students and letting them know that, you know, this is definitely we definitely try to run a fair process in terms of admissions on the law review, and that you shouldn't feel that you're going to be disadvantaged in any way because of your background.
This St. Patrick's Day, one group hopes the luck of the Irish will draw attention to the plight of illegal immigrants. Lindsay Gill reports from San Francisco.
Experts estimate there are more than 40,000 illegal Irish immigrants in the United States today. Their ancestors came more than a century ago. Here in the San Francisco Bay Area, the number is closer to 4,000.
It's a very welcoming place for them to come to. They just love it here.
As president of the Irish Immigration Pastoral Center, Brendan McBride offers support to Irish immigrants in San Francisco.
Work is good, like it pays well. But a lot of them have qualifications as nurses, as psychologists, but they're not able to get into that workforce.
Because of their illegal status, the Irish immigrants can't get a driver's license, and it's difficult to open a bank account. At the same time, the federal government is trying to track them down.
The immigrants we spoke with didn't want to appear on camera. One bartender tells us they just don't know who to trust. She says undercover INS agents have been showing up at local bars.
Still, it hasn't stopped many immigrants and activists from lobbying for reform. Last week, thousands traveled to Washington, D.C. to rally support for legislation sponsored by Senators John McCain and Ted Kennedy. It would allow the undocumented to legally become permanent residents.
I mean, everybody is for security and secure borders. Nobody wants to see another 9/11. But I think that we do need to get them out, to get driver's license, to get them on the roads, insured, you know, to make it safer for everybody.
Right now, the Senate Judiciary Committee is battling whether to pass the bill on to the full Senate. For CNS News, I'm Lindsay Gill in San Francisco.
If St. Patrick's Day isn't your thing, you'll find plenty of other green at the Cow Palace, where the San Francisco Flower and Garden Show is in full bloom. For amateur gardeners, it's a place to get inspiration and ideas. For professional landscapers, it's a venue to show off. Sarah Hayward won Best of Show for this display. The Garden Show runs through Sunday. The Bay Area is about to get a double dose of March Madness. Both of Cal's basketball teams, men's and women's, made the cut. As Raquel Maria Dillon reports, Cal's star forward is already a hometown hero.
Tonight, UC Berkeley's men's basketball team will play in the NCAA tournament for the first time since 2003. They'll be led by Leon Poe. And before Poe was a Golden Bear, he was an Oakland Tech Bulldog.
In high school, the 6'8" forward dominated the Oakland Athletic League and maintained a 3.1 grade point average. He's one of a growing number of Tech athletes who've gone on to Cal.
We're really proud of, right now, four scholarship athletes at Berkeley, and not just scholarship athletes, but probably the faces of men's basketball, women's basketball, and Cal football.
Zuckerman isn't a coach. He's an English teacher who still tutors Poe today. Tech is a tough urban school, but student athletes here are groomed for success.
We feel that we give them a really good background and help them understand that it's not just about being good at your sport, it's also about taking school seriously and putting in the time.
Alexis and Devonay.
The teachers at Tech take the time to follow the careers of Poe and other high-flying alumni. Athletic director Karen Jones says Poe's success belongs to the whole school.
We're kind of family. We're like real family. So he was always surrounded every day with everybody who cared about him.
Now this is when they were showing the nomination.
The school really was like Poe's family. He was a foster kid throughout high school, but he got the kind of tough love that Tech athletes are used to.
Our coaches, they write us a lot about grades.
I think we have a great coaching staff, and they really care about us. It's not just like about the sports. They care about our grades.
They not only teach you about sports, but they also get you ready for things in life. They teach you a lot of discipline and like teach you how to be responsible for yourself.
Poe is playing so well this season, there's talk that next year he may leave Cal for the NBA. It's a big decision. What does his longtime tutor think?
If the situation is right, then we'll make that decision when the time comes. But at this point, the only thing he's focused on is beating NC State.
For CNS, I'm Raquel Maria Dillon, reporting from Oakland.
Catch the Cal Bears opener against North Carolina State this afternoon at 4:20. The Lady Bears play St. John's on Sunday morning. Call them smart, call them ambitious, just don't call them geeks. Julie Kane reports from San Jose on Silicon Valley's next generation of innovators.
We're here on San Jose State's campus, where 41 teams are competing for a place in the National First Robotics Championships. For 600 high school students from California, Hawaii, and Montana, this week may just be the highlight of their entire year.
So I feel really grateful to be able to do something I really enjoy, rather than try and have to be the jock or anything like that.
Each team has had just 6 weeks to design, build, and test a robot. Now, it can't just be any robot. It has to perform a set of required tasks. Pick up balls, shoot them into a goal, and then climb a ramp to the finish. Building robots isn't exactly what people expect out of a bunch of Girl Scouts. But this team, the Space Cookies, is doing precisely that.
We had people last night who were at NASA until at least 11, I think, just packing stuff up to bring out here.
For many of the kids here today, it's not just about the competition. It's also about a shot at over $8 million in scholarships. Companies like Raytheon, Google, and NASA sponsor these teams, hoping to find their next generation of engineers.
The fact that we're facing a tremendous shortage in engineering and science careers in the future.
After weeks of hard work, these 41 teams finally have a chance to put their robots to the test. But 6 weeks of all-nighters doesn't necessarily guarantee success.
We got some balls stuck in the electronics, and I don't know how they got there because we had leg stand to protect it. They got in between the leg stand and the electronics, and I think it messed up the speed controllers.
Then again, success isn't exactly the point.
Just the fact that they've been able to produce a robot in 6 weeks and be out here on the floor and now being able to go out and compete with that robot is a fantastic accomplishment for all of these teams.
Today was just a practice run. The Space Cookies have one more night to work out the kinks with their robot. Tomorrow, they'll compete for the chance to travel to Atlanta for the national championships this April.
For CNS Action News, this is Julie Kane in San Jose.
That's all the news we could fit into one day. I'm Pam Harris. For all of us at CNS Action News, have a good weekend.